Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest this morning, Dr. Joel Green, who's the project scientist in the Office of Public Outreach at the Space Telescope Institute, Science Institute, which is the home of the Hubble, and of course the upcoming JWST, James Webb Space Telescope. After 20 plus years of incredible pictures from Hubble, it's hard to believe that JWST will be, well, maybe 100 times more powerful. We're looking forward to speaking with Dr. Green again.
And good morning, John. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Our second guests this morning are first robotic competitors from Park City High School. We'll be speaking with freshman Slade Schemmer, junior Caden Schindler, and senior Zena Horman. They're all part of the RoboMiners team. Ivo Cho is a sophomore representing the all-girls team. That's called Ultimum Dominarum. We look forward to hearing all about the first robotics competition that took place in Park City several weeks ago.
These two guests plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report every weekday at 6:50 and 7:50 during the morning news with Leslie Thatcher. Brought to you in part by Big D Construction, DeJuria Center at High Star Ranch, and ESCO Heating, Air Conditioning, Plumbing, and Electrical. That's ESCO, E-S-C-O.
Hi, I'm Courtney Johansson, owner of 350 Main Brasserie, and we are pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is newly renovated and located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street. We are open nightly at 5:30 p.m. and serve eclectic American cuisine. Reservations, menu, and contact information at 350main.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's accessible, educational, and fun. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest, Dr. Joel Green. He's the project scientist in the Office of Public Outreach at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Green was with us in March 2017 to talk about the extraordinary achievements of the Hubble Space Telescope. He joins us today to talk about future space telescopes that will launch starting in 2019. Dr. Green, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. And, you know, for over 20 years, Hubble's produced the most mind-blowing pictures of the cosmos, and we really enjoyed our conversation with you last March. It's really hard to believe that the space telescopes that are coming along, starting in 2019 and the early 2020s, are so much more time, many more times powerful than Hubble. Maybe you could just give us sort of a thumbnail sketch of what's coming down the pike.
Well, let me start with the James Webb Space Telescope, because that's near and dear to my heart. The operations center for which is actually located in our building here in Maryland. And these are all NASA's sort of next exploratory missions to really push the envelope of our knowledge beyond that which Hubble is actively doing and will do in the future. And so these are, in some sense, complements to Hubble in that their science cases are a little bit different than what Hubble can do. Their capabilities are somewhat different. And then in other ways, they expand upon or continue along themes that Hubble does, as well as leading us, hopefully, into totally unknown areas of science. So the James Webb Space Telescope is an infrared telescope, and that means that it will see a different kind of light than Hubble does. Infrared is redder than red. It is light beyond that which our eyes can perceive, but you've probably seen it through things like night vision goggles. Some animals are capable of seeing infrared light, and this light is given off by things that are a little bit cooler than things that Hubble looks at, things that it might be room temperature, for example. And this allows us to do a lot of different things. And so James Webb's capabilities are sort of the next generational step. Beyond that, the WFIRST, the Wide Field Infrared Survey Telescope, which is proposed to launch in the mid to late 2020s, is a Hubble-sized telescope, but has 100 times the field of view of Hubble. So we'll be making pictures kind of like Hubble's quality, but 100 times larger. And so you can imagine what that might reveal about the universe, and I can go into more detail about that. Of course, there are missions like Kepler and TESS that are exploring the population of planets that are around the nearest stars to us. This is TESS's focus. It'll look at the stars within the nearest 200 light years of the Earth. And once we have an inventory of what planets are out there, telescopes like James Webb will be able to tell us what the gases in their atmospheres are like, what their compositions are like, and what that might tell us about their environment. And then finally, looking to the very distant future, what we'd like to do is expand upon all of these capabilities and take that first picture, that first spectrum of another Earth out beyond, you know, around one of these other stars, and really see if we can narrow in on planets that might be most analogous to our own.
Wow, fascinating. And back to what you said about the JWST, the James Webb Space Telescope, will be expanding on some of the things that that Hubble did. I just want to tell our listeners from my understanding, and you can certainly correct me, Hubble was in a relatively low orbit, and its infrared capability was marred by the heat of the Earth. The JWST will be what you call L2, which is about a million miles, rather than a couple hundred miles, it'll be a million miles from the Earth, where it's very cold, and you're going to have like a tennis court size shield that will keep the hot side of the sun away from the instrumentation package and away from the mirrors and everything, so that you can really focus in on infrared like it's never been done before. You know, I probably screwed that up, but maybe you can help me with that.
Well, no, absolutely, everything you just said was correct. The Hubble was designed for visible light imaging and ultraviolet imaging, things that benefit from being above our atmosphere, which is great because our atmosphere is wonderful because we can breathe the air. But what it really does is it blocks a lot of different kinds of light that would be harmful to us, but are very interesting from the perspective of an astronomer looking at the universe. Now, our atmosphere also blocks quite a bit of infrared light, particularly through water vapor and things like that. So, you know, when you're looking out and you're trying to look for, let's say, water in the universe, you don't want to be looking through a thicket of water right above you. So getting above the atmosphere is really key, and that's why Hubble was a few hundred miles up. But because it was designed to do visible light imaging and because it was designed to be serviced by humans, unlike any of these other telescopes, it needed to be very close. And this has a couple of minor disadvantages, one of which is that Hubble is behind the Earth for half of its orbit. So it sort of uses that time to calibrate, and there's some efficiency that it can do, but half the time it cannot be doing astrophysics. This is not a problem for James Webb. You take telescopes and we put them now a million miles away at the second Lagrange point, which is a stable point about 1 million miles further from the sun than the Earth is from the sun. So in other words, the Earth is about, you know, 95 million miles from the sun. This is 1 million miles farther. So that means it sort of follows us around the sun during our year. So it has the same year as we do. This has a couple of advantages. All of the things that are bright in infrared, remember I said that infrared was room temperature, the Earth is a huge infrared source. And so getting away from the Earth is really important, and even more important is having this sun shield that you talk about that can block out the Earth, Moon, and Sun. And when you're at L2, the advantage is the Earth, Moon, and Sun are all in the same direction, you know, back towards the Sun. So you can block out all three. This means you could be observing 24/7 in theory.
And you're always pointed towards deep space.
That's right. You're always pointed toward deep space. And so throughout the year, you eventually get access to the entire sky, but you can't point too close to or too far away from the sun because of the way the shield works. So you have to wait a little while till your target comes into view.
Joel, good morning. I'm so curious about, you know, we talk about the Hubble and we think it's quite advanced, and it is, and it's been doing great things. And then we talk about, oh, yes, the next space telescope, the James Webb. I think we don't fully understand the vast difference about what these two telescopes will achieve. So maybe you could just go back a bit and talk about the Hubble Space Telescope and what are the greatest things we've learned from its orbit.
Absolutely. So remember that when Hubble launched, it was 1990.
Yeah.
One of the original concept designs for Hubble was actually to have, I think, film canisters dropped into the ocean to be picked up. This was a long time ago. I mean, fortunately, they were saved by the invention of digital data. But this concept has been in the works, in theory, since the 40s and 50s when it was originally conceived. And so the Hubble was in the context of the time, this was the first time we'd really put a major telescope into space to kind of explore the universe. So we didn't know what we would find. there are some things we now take for granted today that did not, that were totally unknown in 1990. We had never seen a planet around another star. So science fiction writers figured there probably were, but we had never seen one. So we certainly didn't know what planets were like or what their distribution was around the universe. We had never heard of we'd never seen a brown dwarf. We really had not observed the formation of planetary systems. We had not seen, we'd never heard of dark energy. We'd never heard of dark matter. And these things that were discovered a little bit later, particularly dark energy during the Hubble mission, was entirely new physics. And so these are unanticipated physics and unanticipated things that Hubble was able to study anyway. So Hubble's mission was to kind of go out there and take an inventory of the universe and see what it was. But it was such a generational leap over everything on the ground that there was a lot of surprising stuff. And so at some point it became apparent that we would need new capabilities. To Hubble's credit, it could do a ton of things.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few things it can't do. Because it can't see infrared light, it can't see through dusty regions, dusty clouds. It's the same reason you sort of, at sunset, if you imagine a cloud that's sort of backlit by the sun and you sort of see the cloud as a shadow, if you look at the Hubble's picture of the pillars of creation, for example, it looks like a shadow. And that's because it is. We can't see what's going on in there. And for my personal research interest, that's my favorite kind of area. Dusty, gassy areas are where planets and stars are born. Hubble can't see that at all. So the James Webb Space Telescope is optimized to detect that kind of thing. One of the other big areas which Hubble can't cover at all is the very earliest galaxies ever to have formed in the universe, because their light is stretched as the universe itself has stretched over the billions of years, such that their light, which was originally came out as ultraviolet or visible light, is now stretched into the infrared, and Hubble can't see it anymore. So in order to observe the very first galaxies, you need to be able to see infrared light. And so these are two major questions that Hubble can't answer. A third one, just to throw it in, is atmospheres of planets around other stars. Hubble did measure a gas. I think it was the first telescope to measure gas in the atmosphere of a planet, but what it can't do is measure things like organics, like oxygen, carbon dioxide, methane, things you might associate with an early Earth. These are right in James Webb's wheelhouse. And so there are a lot of capabilities, sort of scientific capabilities. And so then the technology needed to be developed to actually to be able to address these scientific questions. So we started with the questions, then we said, what do we need to build to answer these questions?
Wow, that's so exciting. And I love your term, unanticipated physics. So the unanticipated physics that may be created from the James Webb Space Telescope, even imagine them. Who knows? Yeah. I guess that's when the word quantum sort of makes sense, you know? So let's take, for example, the closest star to the Earth, Proxima Centauri. Let's talk about what the James Webb Telescope may do, you know, what we have an idea of and what the James Webb Telescope may allow us to see there as a, for example.
So that's an interesting challenge. So one of the ways that, I think the most interesting thing, right, would be to sort of analyze the composition of, say, a planet around Proxima Centauri. The problem with that is that James Webb's techniques there are two ways that it can find planets. One of them is called direct imaging, which is taking a picture, blocking out the light from the star with some sort of shade, like an occulter. So either a coronagraph, in this case, in James Webb, or so you could imagine something that was external to the telescope. But James Webb has a coronagraph, and that's great. That'll blot out the light of the central star. But it turns out that the planets that have already been detected around Proxima Centauri are not in the range where they could be seen by that technique. So what you would need is for a planet to transit in front of Proxima Centauri. That's to say, it's sort of a small eclipse, essentially. A planet passes in front and shadows a small amount of that star, blocking out some of that light. And the deficit that's missing is the planet and its atmosphere as seen through the star. The problem is we know that the Proxima Centauri planets that have been detected don't transit their star. So James Webb is not, in other words, Proxima Centauri specifically is not really the target, but it could do this on any star nearby that has transiting planets. Similarly, if there were the third or fourth nearest objects are what are called brown dwarfs, that is, failed stars or sort of super Jupiter type things. These are almost like huge versions of planets, and it can directly study those and their atmospheres, which should tell us quite a bit about how gas giant planets around other stars might work. But specifically with Proxima Centauri, that's not going to be a major priority for James Webb.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Joel Green, who's the project scientist in the Office of Public Outreach at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore. His team will have operational responsibilities for the JWST, James Webb Space Telescope. And you also work with Goddard. And, I mean, there are so many different partners that are involved in this, aren't there?
That's right. So Goddard is, of course, we're their contractor. So Goddard is currently the operations center for the Hubble Space Telescope, and they have this gigantic clean room. They're heavily involved in the testing of the James Webb mirrors, so they played a major role in that, and they sort of run the contract. And so they're sort of our lead. But what the telescope was built by many companies, including several others, but primarily by Northrop Grumman.
Right.
And that was developed in various places and is now it's actually about to ship out to their facility in Redondo Beach for the SunShield deployment testing.
Okay.
So the mirrors were fabricated one place, that was by universities primarily, and the SunShield was built by Northrop Grumman.
We were speaking earlier about James Webb being about a million miles out and always looking into deep space on the cold side, where the instrumentation package is for capturing these extraordinary infrared pictures that we're anticipating. But on the tennis court side is where the computer and all the other stuff is, and that's on the warm side that faces the sun, the moon, and the Earth. All objects give off infrared, so it sort of shields. I received a text during our conversation here, somebody asking, what's the temperature on the warm side? What's the temperature on the cold side of James Webb?
That's right. So there's a huge temperature difference. So I'm going to guess slightly here, but I believe the temperature on the cold side is about it's about 30 or 40 degrees Kelvin above absolute zero, so it's sort of minus 400 or something like that degrees Fahrenheit. Mm-hmm. And on the warm side, it can be, several hundred degrees Fahrenheit, because it's direct sunlight sort of shining straight on the thing. So the idea is you want to put all of your warm side adapted stuff on that side. So, for example, things that benefit from sunlight, like solar panels, or things that need to be able to interface with Earth, like the high-gain antenna that sends information back and forth, right, that receives commands, that sends data back. So you put all of that stuff on that side, and then you spend a lot of work thermally sealing the cold and hot side so they don't exchange information or heat.
Right.
And so that's sort of one of the big challenges of a telescope like this, and what a lot of the testing is focused on.
And all atoms.
It's about a 600-degree difference.
Wow.
Yeah. All atoms give off infrared, so James Webb, as a telescope, needs to shield itself from this instrumentation package.
That's right. So James Webb, has a temperature, and the warmer that temperature would be, the more it would interfere with what it's seeing astrophysically. And so it has to be kept cool. Now, the sun shield will drop it, as I said, down quite cold. But one of the instruments on it, the mid-infrared instrument called MIRI, actually has its own separate cryocooler, which keeps it at a colder temperature. Essentially, the more into the infrared you go, the more of a problem the heat background becomes, and so the more cold you need to get to really get good observation. And so MIRI is a little special. It has its extra cool refrigerator, essentially. And there's no, I should point out, there's no consumable here. There's nothing that's going to run out.
Yeah.
This is all powered. And so this can keep going, as long as it lasts, basically.
Wow. You can just feel your excitement. Your excitement about the James Webb telescope is palpable. And I love that because, I think that it's something we can all appreciate if we just learn a little bit about it, if we just kind of hype up our science curiosity a bit. And part of what I think helps me in that is to know what's going on locally. And within the project, I mean, I don't know, how many different contractors are there for the James Webb Space Telescope, for example?
I'm going to guess on the order of 30 to 40. Think of it as a three-way partnership between industry, academia, and government.
Yeah. Wow.
Something like that, 30 to 40.
So you mentioned...
There actually is a list I could point you to.
Right. Well, I'm curious, what's being manufactured, what's being tested, what's being researched here in Utah? Because I know there are certain portions of it that are being worked on down in the Salt Lake Valley and also in northern Utah, I think at ATK, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, Orbital ATK is involved. Yes, that's correct. Also, the University of Utah and other places like that have very active programs and are, on the science side, are very involved in proposing for, we're going to be some of the first people to use this telescope. I actually visited the University of Utah just a couple of weeks ago and had a chat with some of the faculty there and students there about what they're interested in doing on the telescope.
Wow. And
they're not the only university. I think also, certainly BYU and others are very interested as well.
Right. And so the Telescope Science Institute, isn't it sort of made up of a consortium of universities? And how many universities?
That's right. So our slightly unpronounceable name, Space Telescope Science Institute, is we are part of a nonprofit company called ORA, the Association Associated Universities for Research and Astronomy. And that company runs, the Hubble, James Webb, and a few other telescopes you might be familiar with. And the reason that setup happened is essentially that the NASA was very interested in having the astronomers, who are mostly not at NASA, mm-hmm. Sort of help direct the plans and the strategy for using these telescopes. So essentially this organization, Space Telescope, was set up to operate and provide an interface between NASA and the astronomy community. So we serve several interesting functions. So there are, as you say, there are 45 or 50 different universities involved in Space Telescope, and as well as contributions from the European Space Agency and the Canadian Space Agency. So we represent a bit of an international consortium, which is really fun. And I should point out that the European Space Agency and Canadian Space Agency are both partners in James Webb, and the ESA is actually launching the telescope on an Ariane 5 rocket next year, or 2019. But this collaboration, essentially means that we sort of act as a feedback between these different groups. So, for example, let's say that, to prioritize which instruments should be used and which science, anticipate which science cases there are, to anticipate what the needs might be, to provide software development or hardware development that might support observations in science on this telescope. So it's kind of a really fun place to be because it's very much a service-oriented kind of organization, but it's such a wide variety of expertise. And what's really, I think, fun for me personally is what we do is we also communicate and help communicate and distribute the sort of scientific results to the world at large, sort of help translate and understand, some of the jargon, turn it into something that's a little bit more palatable to the world.
Absolutely.
So that's one of the most exciting things.
That's what we try to do here on the program as well. One of the most awe-inspiring pictures from Hubble was the deep field study, which looks at the other side of the universe. And my professor in Boston described it to me as like akin to holding a grain of sand at arm's length and collecting light for 2 weeks, focusing on that and coming up with those extraordinary pictures. Now with James Webb, and as you said earlier, because of cosmological redshifting, everything is infrared way, way, way out there. So James Webb is the perfect device to really take a peek at what's on the other side there. What sort of things are we expecting to find? More granularity, more detail, or can we look even further than those deep field studies?
There are a number of things. So Hubble's field of view, as you said, is really small. Imagine holding a drinking straw at arm's length and looking through it. That tiny little sliver is the picture, the size of a picture in terms of angle that Hubble would take. And so that field that you're looking at holds 10,000 galaxies in it that Hubble could see. By the way, the one of the big cases for the WFIRST telescope, the Wide Field Infrared Survey, is that it will be 100 times bigger than that with the same kind of crispness. So then your 10,000 galaxies become 1 million. So it's going to be really interesting. Every picture from that telescope is going to be stunning. But what the difference will be, so when Hubble looked back in time, it could see galaxies of different colors, sizes, shapes, and as they got farther back in time, We started to notice that they started looking a little bit more compact, centrally concentrated, in some cases dustier. And so what we're looking for, and we anticipate finding, is the point at which the, you know, because we're looking back in time as well as space, is that if you go far enough back in time, there should be a point at which the universe was actually substantially different in terms of its media, that the hydrogen, which makes up 75% of the universe, was at some point atomic, meaning its electrons were still attached to the protons. That's not the case today. It's ionized. And so there should be a point, or maybe a short time, over which the universe was ionized by something. Energy was casting about. So we're looking at a very exotic time. But furthermore, galaxies themselves, we think, form at the sort of nodes of these dark matter strands. Now, we can't see dark matter directly, but we can certainly see what the very first galaxies would look like. And you might expect then that they might be smaller or more compact. They might have stars in them that don't have a lot of elements other than hydrogen because they haven't gone through generations of fusion to make elements that are heavier. So they might have very different behavior. And so we may sort of, you know, find a point at which, before that, there are no galaxies. And if we find that point, then we found the hypothetical dark ages,
right,
that we know must have started early in the universe.
The dark ages.
We may come to the end.
Yeah. I know that these devices may reveal questions that we haven't even thought to ask yet, and that's really exciting. But, you know, you seem like a pretty curious person. What one or two questions would you like to have answered that have not been answered yet?
Well, now I'm gonna plug what I'm most interested in, which is how planets are born. I would really like to know what a typical planetary system is like, and the best way to figure that out is to study new planets that are being born around other stars today, and see what tracks they take that might be different than our own. So, for me, the burning question is, you know, how do you get an Earth? How do you get a Jupiter? How do you get a Saturn? How do these types of planets come about, and how are they different? What things could have changed in the evolution of our solar system that would have given us a totally different system? And I think this is a question that's very much within our grasp. James Webb has amazing ability to, you know, obviously look at intensely good resolution at these systems and tell us a little bit about how they vary, you know, as a function of distance from their star. But it can also tell us very specific things about the mineral composition and the ices, things that form under very, very specific heating and cooling conditions that will tell us about the history of that system. We can project back then and kind of understand what makes a typical system and, you know, is ours typical? And therefore, you know, if we are typical, are we alone?
I love to hear the answer to that question. What one thing would you like to have answered? Because there's never a pause with scientists. Just like you did, Joel, you knew exactly what it was. You launched right into it. And meanwhile, I'm back here thinking about what one or two questions I'd like to have answered, which go back to...
Well, this is my bias, of course.
Yeah.
It's a good bias.
Yes, it is. And, you know, to take it back to the layperson who's listening to Cool Science Radio, and who's just getting curious about this, I'd like to go back again to some comparisons between Hubble and James Webb. So Hubble's at about 200 miles up. James Webb, again, as we've said, will be a million miles into space, and it will launch in the spring of 2019. How long is it going to take to be put in place a million miles into space? What's the journey?
So it's actually quite quick in the cosmic sense. The telescope should be coasting out there in about 30 days. It should be inserted into its orbit. And then there will be it'll do a whole bunch of unfoldings as it goes out. And then it will be inserted into this orbit around L2. And so in about 30 days, it'll be where it should be.
Incredible.
But it'll take about 150 days more before the testing of all the instruments is complete and everything works and we can take pictures. So there's going to be a very, period where everyone's going to be very anticipating and very frustrated that we haven't put any pictures yet. So just to warn everyone, there'll be a little bit of a quiet period between the arrival and the first pictures.
So nearly...
The anticipation will have to build.
Right. Nearly a year. And I'm sure you'll be putting out lots of information in that time to hype it up and get people excited about what they will see.
We will certainly be teasing all of the previews.
And then you talk...
And we know what we want to find.
Yeah. So you talk about that period of testing and making sure you've got everything going in terms of the technology it takes to take pictures. But tell us about, you know, things like how it'll be serviced. What if something goes wrong? It's not like you can service it at all, right?
That's right. So we can't send a human being out to fix it. So there are obviously certain really catastrophic things you could imagine that could go wrong that we couldn't fix. But these are very unlikely.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of things you can do with software from the ground and that we frequently do with other telescopes from the ground. So there's not a lot of reasons you would need to go out there. It just was not built for servicing. Hubble's famous for having this spherical aberration on its mirror, this mirror issue. So one of the things that James Webb has done in testing, it's obviously that is not an issue. First of all, because the mirrors were tested more rigorously, but also because in this case, each segment can move relative to the other. So we can focus it in different ways. So imagine, for example, if one of the mirrors was askew, the others could compensate for it,
right?
Or we could adjust it if it was still operable. So there are a lot of things that could happen to a little piece of it that are very, very much avoidable. I mean, we don't anticipate any issues, but lots of these sort of things are picked up in testing, and that's why it's launching in spring of 2019 and not taking off tomorrow, because we really want to test each stage of the assembly as a unit and as a separate piece. And we've been running what are called sort of day-in-the-life tests. You know, imagine we're operating. How would it go? Sort of, you know, drills, sort of very interesting examinations of different scenarios and how we would react. So we're very, I would say we're very cautious but very optimistic about the operations of this telescope.
Well, it's time for me to date myself. Looking at old Star Trek episodes, you would actually see Kirk turn to Spock and say, as they came up on a new planet, he'd say, "Spock, what's the biosignature of that new planet?" And Spock would say, "Captain, it's so much oxygen, so much water, so much methane, so much ozone." And that was absolutely far out science fiction. You have something on the planning board. It may not be completely fleshed out yet, but it's out there a bit. It's called At Last, where you're going to be able to do exactly that. Is that something that is funded, or is that something you're just looking at? What's the status on At Last?
That's a great question. So a couple of things. First of all, James Webb will do some of this as well, just not necessarily on Earth, exact Earth analogs. So, James Webb might be able to detect the atmospheres of planets that are generally larger than Earth and generally around stars that are smaller than the sun. Whereas a telescope that was bigger could just achieve that slightly better resolution enough to see an Earth around a G-star. And so the advantage would be that we could then make these kinds of measurements, these biosignature tests on planets that are extremely similar to what we're used to, if they are out there at all. That's very exciting. So there were various concepts proposed for this, because Hubble's resolution is not sufficient to do this on most planets. And so At Last is one name for a few different things. Essentially, the idea is these are telescopes that are actually bigger in general than James Webb. So Hubble is 2.4 meters in diameter mirror, so that's about 8 feet. James Webb is about 6.5 meters, or 21 feet. And one concept, a LUVOIR, another name for it, is about 12 to 14 to 15 meters in diameter. So that means it's about 50 feet, 60
yeah.
feet, something like that. Huge telescopes. Using some of the same technology demonstrations from James Webb and from WFIRST, so the hexagonal mirrors or the coronagraph, things like that. And so these concepts are to, achieve that resolution improvement such that we can see those kinds of planets, and that's what's going to get us. So there are the context of this is that NASA plans very far ahead. These missions take a long time to develop. As I said, Hubble was sort of originally proposed in the 70s, launched in the 90s. James Webb was proposed in the late 90s. It's going to launch about 20 years later. So anything that we want to have go up that we're planning now would not be going up until the 2030s, certainly. And that means we need to be thinking about what are the top science discovery priorities that we have for the future. What can we do to extend our capabilities? And there are a number of concepts that are being developed and reviewed, essentially, for their science value by the astronomy community in what's called the Decadal Survey. So 2020 is sort of the big delivery date for all of these proposals. So I think a major decision is going to happen, you know, in the early 2020s about which of these missions moves forward. And so one of the concepts is this giant ATLAST or LUVOIR telescope. Mm-hmm. Another concept, for example, is a giant X-ray telescope. So there are some very interesting experiments you can do, but I really, these are sort of the bold vision for the next 20 years, you know, sort of roadmap for future discoveries kind of thing.
Well, it's all very exciting. And Dr. Joel Green is the project scientist in the Office of Public Outreach at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Green, if you're ever down at University of Utah again, come on up and see us in Park City. Lynn and I would love to have lunch with you and talk with you further.
That's right.
I'd be delighted to do that.
Thanks,
okay.
Joel.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you again.
Well, we're going to go to a couple of underwriters, and when we return, we've got the kids from Park City High who won the recent FIRST Robotics competition a couple weeks ago at Park City High.
Hi, this is Steve Roney Jr. from Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. We are a proud supporter of KPCW and our Park City community. Our agents are located in Summit and Wasatch counties, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com or 649-7171.
Earl Foote here with Nexus IT, happy to keep KPCW Radio and their staff running smoothly. We provide sales and maintenance on all computer systems and can guide our customers about cloud solutions for their businesses or personal computer needs. More info available at 435-487-9099 or nexusitc.net.
Hi, I'm Whitney Wall from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including Snowfest, the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all the events happening at Park City Mountain this winter can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. We were just speaking with Dr. Joel Green from the Space Telescope Science Institute. Wow, that was a wild ride just speaking to Dr. Green, but really interesting stuff. Well, let's bring it home to Park City now. FIRST Robotics Competition is an international high school robotics competition. Now, each year, teams of high school students, coaches, and mentors work during a six-week period to build game-playing robots that weigh up to 120 pounds. A couple of weeks ago, on a Saturday, 25 teams across Utah competed in a day-long event at Park City High School. Three Park City teams, the Robo Miners, the Inconceivables, and Nuclear Mines, I love the names of these teams, they all made it to the semifinals, and then the Robo Miners won it all. Joining us now in the studio, we have kids from really every grade here. We've got freshman Slade Schimmer, junior Caden Schindler, senior Zina Horman from the Robo Miners team, and Eva Cho, who represents the all-girls team called Ultimum Dominarum. Welcome, everyone, to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having us.
Well, let's start over here with Zina. First of all, FIRST Robotics stands for inspiration and recognition of science and technology. And that's really what it's about. For you, how interested were you in science and technology? You know, did you have to have the interest first to join the team? Or do you think there are kids out there that just say, robotics? Huh, that sounds cool. I think I'll try it.
You know, that's kind of where I started. It was in fifth grade. There was a flyer going around for a robotics team, and it's actually the younger version of what we do now. And I was like, hey, I might be good at this. Like, this looks like fun. We play with Legos and robots.
Yeah. So, Eva, if you can explain, you start off, say, in fifth grade with, I think it's a Lego sort of inspired robot. Is that how it works? Talk about the different stages that you learn as you grow up through robotics.
Yeah, for sure. So there's this thing called FIRST Lego League, and that is kind of in the same realm as what we do, but using Legos. And that is definitely for a younger generation. And that kind of can definitely grasp a young person's mind and kind of lead into FDC or FRC, which is what we do. And yeah.
What do those acronyms stand for?
So FTC is First Tech Challenge and FRC is First Robotics Challenge. And FTC is what we do, but First Robotics Challenge, like, they build way larger robots. And yeah, great.
Iva, you've got to tell us about the name of your team.
Yes, so my team name is Ultimum Dominarum, and that actually means Ultimate Ladies in Latin, and that is kind of our whole message as a team. We are advocates for women in STEM and are trying to encourage as many young women to join the STEM field.
I was out there a couple of Saturdays ago, and I spent the afternoon there watching the competition and watching the Robo Miners grab the final prize, and it was really exciting. And I had an opportunity to talk to a couple of kids from St. George, another kid, I forget where she was from, and I talked to some of you. And consistently, all of you said that you were involved in a STEM-based curriculum now, that you were very interested in it, but it was robotics that got you initially interested in all of that. Is that the same experience that you all have? Caden, let me ask you.
Well, I started just enjoying to program and mm-hmm. doing all that, and then I learned about the robotics, came, joined, and so I could take my programming skills and put them into a real-world situation and see what I and bring stuff to life with it, and that's just carried me further into STEM and wanting to know more about it.
Okay. And Slade, you're not on the programming side. You are a driver, and we'll be talking about what that means in a second. But did you have the same experience yourself?
Yeah, I wasn't really interested in STEM-based stuff, but at my school, I saw a flyer going around for robotics. I'm like, huh, this seems cool. So I tried it last year, and I got hooked on the first day. So, yeah.
And, yeah, if I can speak to that a little bit, I had no idea what STEM was when I started out with robotics, and it really definitely helped me get introduced to that kind of path, and I don't think I would be where I am now without robotics. And that really speaks true to a lot of the people in our robotics club. We have over 60 active members, and we actually, as a team, our Robo Miners, we want to give back to that. And so we actually teach a robotics-based STEM curriculum at the local McPullen Elementary because, I mean, I know how much that helped me, help my career, you know, set me on the path where I'm going.
That's so great to hear. Caden, I want to go back to you for a second because you said that you enjoy programming. And yet this gave you a different forum or venue to see what you're, you know, sitting in front of a screen doing, that it's this actual physical manifestation of something moving across the room that you have programmed. And I don't know a lot about programming, but I can only imagine that that's got to be way more, well, it's satisfying in a different way. So could you just talk a little bit about that, maybe the difference between programming and what you can see happen on a screen here versus a physical being, a robot?
So when you're doing it in the virtual world on a computer, your numbers and stuff don't have to be as accurate because if it works, it works, and it just kind of does its thing. But with doing it for a robot, say for a servo, the positions have to be accurate, and it's a lot of just test and make sure you're getting those so that it's going to work and get the right go to the right location so that nothing else breaks. And also just everything else has to be a lot more precise, takes a lot more time, and it's if you mess up something in there, then the whole robot's not going to work in general. And so just having to learn how to modify what you're doing so that the robot works and everyone else can kind of understand what's happening in makes it's just in its own way satisfying to know what you've done is coming to life and doing what it needs to do properly.
So if you've programmed it incorrectly, you said that the robot doesn't even really work, but does it ever do sort of some funny things like, you know, one robotic arm, you know, hit someone in the head or something instead of what you sort of designed it to do? And Slade, maybe you can talk about that as the driver.
Yeah, Many times we've experienced some technical difficulties where we initialize the robot and it starts doing something funky like spin around in circles or, I don't know, hitting the wall and ramming things. But it's just a lot of trial and error to get the thing perfected.
Nice.
I want to take a minute and just describe the competition and what happens from my own observations. This is quite an operation, Lynn. Starts at 6:30 in the morning with some of the coordinators, Laura Monti, Gail Stucker, a bunch of people from Park City that come out that are involved in when the 25 schools show up or the 25 teams from around the state show up, they have to make sure that these robots are compliant with the detailed requirements that these robots have to provide. And then, of course, the competition starts. And I was there for the latter part of the afternoon, but there's like 8 or 9 kids per team. You've got programmers, drivers, support people. I mean, there's all these people. And it's like a high school basketball game. Everybody's cheering. There's a lot of noise. There's a lot of enthusiasm. And I was so psyched when we got into the semifinals, and there were a couple of other Park City teams that were in the semis. And then Robo Miners, you guys just dominated at the end. And maybe one of you, if you choose who wants to speak, can talk about the actual competition as it was laid out on this particular day.
Yeah, well, it is quite the endeavor, like you said. It goes from 7 in the morning till at least 7 at night. All the preparation, I mean, it takes months. So we have a few of these every year. You have a few chances to qualify for the state competition. The one you attended was actually a regional competition, which was qualifying teams for state. But yeah, it is quite the preparation. People, I think we put, how many man hours do you think we put into the robot, guys?
Well, just for the CAD, which is the computer aided design for designing the robot and so that we could make it, that was at least 40 plus.
Yeah, and then, yeah, 40, at least 40 hours, and then at least 100 hours building it. From start to finish, it is quite the process.
I've spent a couple of Saturdays just in the robotics room building and working.
Do you sort of lose time? Are you so into it that you just, the whole day goes by? This is what we hope for, right? You know, in anything, any endeavor that we take on, that we get just lost in it.
Yeah, and that can be said for most of the kids in the robotics rooms. Definitely not what they anticipated doing with their Friday afternoons, but they're there into the late hours of the night, just lost in their robot, and it's really a fun thing to experience and be a part of.
So the robots themselves, and Eva, maybe you can take this one, are under 120 pounds. I would assume that's the maximum weight limit. And they're game-playing robots. So what game did your robot play?
So all the teams kind of have the same goal of scoring or picking up these 6x6 foam blocks and placing them into a box that is fitted to the blocks. So that's exactly what our robot does. It has a lift mechanism that can clamp the foam blocks, and it'll drive and ram it into a box, basically. And
does it have to put it in the box in an organized fashion?
If teams want to score more points, that is a way that they can do that. There is a pattern that a team can follow and try to put the blocks in to match that pattern. Yeah.
And there's interesting things to do for extra credit, like getting the relic outside of the field of play, and you get extra points for that. But the Robo Miners were like a machine on that final competition. And as a result of that, and correct me if I'm wrong, you guys are going to go on to the Super Regionals with 13 other states, including California. When is that competition going to take place?
So actually, next we're headed to the state competition, and then if we do well at the state competition, we'll move on to the Super Regionals. But we have our state competition coming up in February.
Boy, a lot of pressure. There's 5,000 teams around the world, and Robo Miners were in the top 0.3% in your world competition last year. How'd that make you feel?
It made us feel incredible because after all that hard work and dedication, we were able to get so far and achieve our dreams.
So, Slade, I wanted to ask you, you're a driver, so what does that mean? You don't do any programming? Do you do any of the building of the robot?
I mainly do driving, but I help with building some of the robot, and I kind of pitch some ideas out if we're kind of in a jam or we want to redesign something or so. I kind of do a little bit of everything, but my main purpose is driving.
He's got the pressure on him because the programming's already been done. There's not much you can do about that when you show up at the competition.
Well, you can blame your programmer if it goes wrong.
You can, but at 6 o'clock at night on the final in the finals, the pressure is on the driver. And I saw this guy sweating a little bit. Is that true?
Yeah. Yes, it was. I mean, it's always a little bit scary, I guess, when you're in the finals because it's just you and those few other teams, and you're just hoping that you could win the thing.
So is the best driver someone who is the best video game player? I mean, is it you have your joysticks? I don't know what you call them.
I guess you could say so, but the best drivers are the ones that put in the most time. You could have a great robot, but if you don't have good drivers, then you might not get very far. But if you have a rookie robot and you drive a ton, then you could get pretty far. So
I think you have to be cool under pressure because there's a lot of people screaming. You're competing with these other teams, and you got to be really cool, don't you?
Yeah, you do. You got to maintain and be calm under pressure.
I can see Slade being just that, calm, cool, under pressure. Okay. This is really great. So the RoboMiners and Ultimum Dominarum, we've got Slade Schemmer, Caden Schindler, Zina Horman, and Eva Cho, who represent these two teams. And best of luck at state and then all regionals and on to, you know, infinity and beyond, as they say. So thanks for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And come back and give us an update on what's going on.
We will, for sure.
Okay.
And we want to thank our underwriters today, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Nexus IT, Habitat for Humanity Restore, the Natural History Museum of Utah, and Park City Mountain. You're listening to KPCW Park City.
Matt here from San Francisco Design, supporting our local radio station, KPCW. Since 1990, San Francisco Design offers interior design and a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings with store locations in Salt Lake City and Park City on Bonanza Drive. On the web at sanfrandesign.com, San Francisco Design. Love your home.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
And thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. John, you've got a few things.
I just wanted to mention that back in November, the RoboMiners were asked to present to the Utah State Legislature about the benefits of robotics programs, which I believe are so important for the encouragement of STEM education. Caden and Zina, you were both part of that presentation. If you could take maybe 10 seconds and just tell us what your experience was presenting to the legislature.
No, it was really, really rewarding and awesome to be able to get to tell our state legislators a little bit more about what this program can offer. Maybe they can offer it to other people.
Kids, get involved in robotics. It's pretty cool.
That's right. I think I remember seeing a picture of you guys with Governor Herbert.
Yeah,
probably. He was looking pretty dazzled at the time. You've been listening to KPCW Park City. It's time to move into National Public Radio News from Washington.